Tom and I first became interested in Thomas Jefferson a few years ago when in the United States we were with friends in Virginia and they took us to Fredericksburg where there was a statue of Thomas Jefferson. And I announced to the small assembled crowd, Thomas Jefferson was a Unitarian. I don't think they were very impressed. He wasn't a paid-up member of a church, and you can decide at the end of the address whether he was or not. Thomas Jefferson was the third president of the USA after George Washington and John Adams. I will say something of his character and political times, and Tom will then say something about the famous Jefferson Bible. My facts for this address were gathered from a book, a biography, Thomas Jefferson, by Fawn Brodie, that by way of Polyguiled, from some Adelaide University notes by way of our granddaughter Helen, who fortuitously was studying that period of American history, and from a tome in Burnside Library, where I checked my dates, a US history encyclopedia. I only knew of Thomas Jefferson, really, in respect of the Declaration of Independence, and because I knew about his beautiful house, Monticello. I now know something more as a result of pleasurable research. Thomas Jefferson was born on April the 13th, 1743, on a plantation of wheat and tobacco in Virginia. His father was long settled in the colony and called the plantation Shadwell, after the part of London where his wife was born. The ancestors on his father's side came from North Wales, near the mountain Snowdon, though the Jefferson family always rated the mountains of Virginia, of course, as much more majestic. Jefferson was the eldest son of this very wealthy family. He was well educated, first at home or locally, then at William and Mary College, where he perfected his Latin and Greek. He was a classicist, able to compose Latin verse. One of the chief, often recognized characteristics of the adult Jefferson was that he was a man of peace. But very early in his life, he was known to be a good hater. And one of the first people he hated was an early teacher, an Anglican clergyman, James Morey. This man was dour. But it was not only his personality that inspired the hatred, but his unalterable belief in the established Anglican Church. The teenager Jefferson was already a dissident with atheistic tendencies. This president in the making, known also to be capable of great kindness, also hated dogs. In a letter to a friend, he said, "It would be better if the whole canine population was exterminated." This was after an attack on some of his merino sheep. Other people he hated included the English King George III and Napoleon, whom he came to detest after he crowned himself emperor. Jefferson had great sympathy and appreciation of the causes of the French Revolution, but he was aghast at how bloody it turned out to be. His character was contradictory. He had a passion for politics, but an equal passion for the pastoral life. He was a great administrator with huge self-confidence, yet claimed to be ambivalent about exercising power, except over his slaves. More of that later. During the War for Independence, as governor of Virginia, he kept himself isolated from real military involvement. He was not a soldier, but preeminently a builder, a legislator, and a tree planter. He loved the peaceful life at Monticello, and he retreated there all his life whenever he could. He needed to be lost in the Virginian landscape. He wrote of the superiority of the pastoral life, uncorrupted by the evils of the city. And for a time, he did renounce politics, but always returned to the battle. He deeply desired a life with channels running in peaceful directions, but neither could he eventually resist the cut and thrust of politics. His was a time when slave labour was accepted as a normal part of society, though abolition societies were being set up, and not only in the North. Jefferson treated his slaves well, and he gave quiet encouragement to Negro education. It is well known that he had a black mistress at Monticello. To more than one of his biographies, this liaison was taboo. The great man should have no recorded imperfections, certainly not moral ones. DNA tests have proved that at least two of Sally Hemings' children were Jefferson's. One can imagine the uproar when news of this concubine became public in the second year of Jefferson's presidency. He survived the humiliation and the lampoons, of which one verse read, "Of all the damsels on the green, on mountain or in valley, alas, so luscious ne'er was seen as Monticellian Sally." The scandal surrounding a more recent president may seem tame by comparison. Jefferson's attitude to slavery seems puzzling to us. Here was a man who legislated for the inalienable right of the individual, yet he had little more than a theoretical interest in the cause of abolition. In 1820, Jefferson wrote, re that debate, "Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other." The scale for him tipped towards self-preservation of the social and economic order. It is well recorded that he agonized over this, and in the end, it was not that the difference between him and the abolitionists was irreconcilable, but that he believed the time was not yet right. Abolition came for the North with President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, nearly 40 years after Jefferson's death. Before he was president, Jefferson was American ambassador to France. As a diplomat, he was described as unconventional, imaginative, and tough. These skills must have been evident some years later with the purchase of Louisiana from the French. The purchase of this great tract of land meant that America almost doubled its size. 909,000 square miles were bought for $15 million. The greatest real estate deal in history, it was said. But the French Foreign Minister, Talleyrand, called it simply a noble bargain. This may be the supreme instance of Jefferson as a man of peace. It was rare, though not unknown, but it was rare for territory to be gained with no shedding of blood. Apart from being the architect of the Declaration of Independence, his two greatest triumphs as president were the Louisiana Purchase and the Great Inland Expedition to the Pacific. Jefferson had learned surveying from his father, and it is said he himself taught it to the expedition leader, Meriwether Lewis. In 1809, Lewis became a national hero as a result of that memorable trip. The signing of the Declaration, the Louisiana Purchase, the opening up of the American continent, great honors enough for any statesman. Yet one other achievement is ascribed to Jefferson: the passing of Bill No. 82 in the Virginian Assembly. This bill separated the ancient meshed power of church and state. And Jefferson himself believed this to be his greatest achievement.
We begin this story of Jefferson's Bible in the Birmingham, England Unitarian Church in 1791. The minister was Joseph Priestley, theologian, scientist, the discoverer of oxygen, although it is said a German scientist separated out oxygen before Priestley, but Priestley got his into print before the German because of some fumbling at the German end. An educational innovator and author of about 150 books. Priestley supported, as you heard Jefferson did, Priestley supported the French Revolution, although he was dismayed by the violence with which it was accomplished. Priestley and members of his church, as well as notably Quakers and Baptists, were understood to be supporters of just about every radical cause, whether related to religious or political freedom. In the riots of 1791, his church and home were burnt down by a mob which was inspired by sympathy for the French Revolution, by his sympathy for the French Revolution, which was displeasing to the Orthodox Church and the King's Party. Priestley decided to move to America, which he did in 1794, followed by his two sons. In America, Priestley corresponded with many Unitarians, including Thomas Jefferson. And they, that is Jefferson and Priestley, agreed on the essentials of Unitarianism. Both men believed that civil and religious freedom were each as important as the other. Both believed that Christianity had become corrupted, both in the records of the New Testament and in the beliefs espoused by the established church and Protestantism. Jefferson often cited Priestley as expressive of his own convictions, especially using Priestley's history of the corruptions of Christianity. One difference between Priestley and Jefferson was that while Priestley was a paid-up, card-carrying Unitarian, Jefferson did not identify himself as such. The political penalties would have been too much, and he declared that I and my religion are a matter between my God and myself. However, every bone in Jefferson's body was Unitarian, and in correspondence with a prominent American Unitarian, made the rash prophecy that there is not a young man now living in the US who will not die an Unitarian. Jefferson and Priestley also agreed that it would be a contribution to true religion to create a Bible which would contain the true sayings and acts of Jesus culled from the Gospels, ignoring the miracles, the virgin birth, claims to Jesus' divinity, the resurrection stories, and the reconstruction of Christianity by St. Paul and the church which he created. Jefferson wrote to John Adams, "In the New Testament there is internal evidence that parts of it have proceeded from an extraordinary man, and that other parts are the fabric of very inferior minds. It is as easy to separate those parts as to pick out diamonds from dunghills." The two principles which Jefferson by which Jefferson was motivated were first that he would put himself in the position of a follower of Jesus. That is, as a Christian in the only sense he could interpret that title. I am a Christian, he wrote. I am a Christian in the only sense he, Jesus, wished anyone to be. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, ascribing to himself every human excellence and believing he never claimed any other. So his first principle was that he stood firmly as a Christian of that kind. Second, his principle was that he would endorse and adopt nothing which contradicted his reason. Reason is our only guide, he wrote. Significantly, Jefferson, having a library, an extensive library, which was eventually sold to Congress, Jefferson put the Bible under the category of history rather than, for example, philosophy or religion. And the implications of that are important. For example, he wished to distance himself from the God of the Old Testament and did this by the implication that such a God is an historical remnant from a distant past. His historical approach to the Bible also determined his attitude toward Jesus. If Jesus, the reformer, prophet, and teacher, was to speak with authority to thinking persons, he wrote, his true image must be abstracted from the web of jargon, blasphemy, and speculation spun by the four evangelists. In other words, the record of the Bible needed historical treatment and was not to be taken at face value. Jefferson thought that Priestley was the better person to create this Bible. So he wrote to Priestley suggesting that he undertake the project. However, Priestley was ill at the time and died in 1804, and it's not known whether he received Jefferson's letter or not. So Jefferson undertook the task. Tradition says with scissors, but it's now thought that he used a razor. Whichever he used, he cut out the verses of the Gospels which made sense to him. He pasted together the English verses with their Greek, Latin, and French translations. Possibly he put the other translations beside his English translation to assist him in understanding how others had read and interpreted the text. Or it might have been simply because he was familiar with those languages. On the table at the back, over there, I've put a copy of Jefferson's Bible, and I've put a bookmark in this page which shows a facsimile of what he actually wrote and how it was then produced. If someone displaces the bookmark, you'll find that page about page 33. The Jefferson Bible began with an account of Jesus' birth without reference to angels, genealogy, prophecy, and miracles. References to the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus and Jesus' resurrection are also absent from the Jefferson Bible. The work ends with the words, "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulchre, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus, and rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed. Words which correspond to the ending of chapter 19 of John in our Bibles. The result was the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth, which was published by Congress, and for a long time copies of which were given to new congressmen. And the contents, said Jefferson, were the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered to man. It was, of course, a Jesus congenial to Jefferson, but that was inevitable, given that he was the sole judge of the material with which he was dealing. It is a Jesus of reason, considerate of women, a friend of all, indeed, you might say, the first Christian gentleman. To put it another way, Forrest Church, a famous US minister now, Forrest Church, in his 1974 thesis, The Gospel According to Thomas Jefferson, for Harvard Divinity School, suggested that Jefferson's was a search not so much for the historical as for the intelligible Jesus. A Jesus, we might say today, to whom Jefferson could relate. If we wish to know something of the Jesus of history, we will have to make our own judgments too. We will need to peer through the mists of time over 2,000 years, the mists of language, Aramaic and Greek, and the mists of culture, Roman, Jewish, and Greek. And it would be remarkable if we came up with an historical or intelligible Jesus who did not bear some resemblance to ourselves. And we would do well to keep in mind always the word of that towering figure, Albert Schweitzer, who searched long and diligently, and some think successfully, for the historical Jesus. And when he had accomplished his great work, he added this sentence: "We are fortunate indeed if we can bring Jesus into our own time, for howsoever short or long a time, before he retreats through the mist into his own time again."